a Democrat out of Alabama, you know, hell is frozen over.
George Washington University's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. My name's Jessica Blackband, and I'll be your moderator for this episode.
And I'm Kat Lundy.
And I'm Matt Dotzler.
Matt Dotzler is our guest on the pod today, so Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so this is our Below the Fold episode, so we're going to go ahead and get started with Kat's Below the Fold.
So on Thursday this week, the Idaho State Education Committee is no longer planning to ban any mention of human-caused climate change in education curriculum. So basically, they are going to be mentioning humans contributing to climate change and differences in the environment, which earlier this year, in February, they had actually planned to remove all mentionings and all rule stating that you had to mention humans as a cause of climate change. And it's actually really interesting that a 17-year-old student in Idaho started a petition and got other high school students, some of them classmates and some of them from other high schools in Idaho, to actually attend public hearings regarding this rule change.
Wow, that's
and
awesome.
I thought, it's a below-the-fold story, but I think it kind of ties into this level of activism you're seeing with younger and younger citizens. And it's also just interesting to see that this push is affecting education, I wouldn't say standards, education standards, but just the curriculum and students actually being able to say what they want to learn about in schools.
Yeah, and being listened to and, like, in a way that makes a difference.
Yeah.
So was it removing a ban on talking about climate change, or was it...
So last year, lawmakers voted to approve new standards, and they deleted five paragraphs of human-caused climate change out of the statewide curriculum in terms of you need to at least cover this in your science class.
Yeah.
And they had hearings, and then students attended these hearings, started petitions, voiced their concerns to their local and state representatives, asking for those five paragraphs to be reinserted into the curriculum for the state.
I think that's really cool that clearly the students have gotten information about climate change and its importance from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's from, like, their media or their social media or what, but that's really neat that they're kind of, I don't know.
It's cool as well to see students so involved and invested in their education.
Yeah.
Or at least in what's going on in government, local and national.
Mm-hmm. I'm also wondering if Idaho has experienced a lot of climate-induced agricultural drought or anything like that, and maybe those students are starting to feel the impacts, and so they feel like it's locally relevant to them.
We've also got population migration.
Yeah, totally.
And this generation, our generation and younger, are leaving faiths in greater numbers. I wonder if there's a difference in questioning our ideology.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting point in that. So the Paleontological Research Institution launched a project to mail copies of a teacher's friendly guide to climate change to every single high school in Idaho after they proposed removing human-caused climate change from education curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if that also had something to do with it. But the article that I have here from Think Progress on the New York Times also did an article on this, mentions that there were science organizations and just STEM think tanks that saw this change about to occur and decided to get engaged with Idaho. Now, it doesn't say specifically that they mailed these to students, but they said that they did get involved with the high schools and school board committees.
I feel like Bill Nye would be proud.
Yes.
That's awesome. That's a really inspiring story. I wonder, I read an article just the other day, I think it was a Pew Research article, they surveyed people around the world, and they found that climate change was second to ISIS in terms of global security threats that people were worried about. I guess I hadn't, and like other things on the list were cyber attacks, the global economy, the number of refugee, like the refugee crisis, all of that.
Oh yeah, I can totally see the refugee crisis as being related.
Yeah.
Isn't it the South Sudan where they're having, like, extreme droughts and people are having to just leave and enter areas that are more dangerous that they've never had to go to before?
Starting to get droughts in the Middle East as well. Turf wars for water in various areas of the world.
Yeah. Cape Town is approaching, I guess they're calling it day zero.
Yep.
Literally going to run out of water. So
California is entering a drought again.
Yep. Yet again, fires are terrible everywhere for way longer than usual. So I just thought it was... I guess I work a lot on climate issues, and it sometimes feels like there's not a lot of progress being made, but the awareness is so there. Like, people are ready to act. So.
In terms of progress, what would you measure as far as, like, a regulation stopping or halting this, or...
Like, slowing carbon emissions, I guess. I mean, there's been some progress on that in recent decades. Like, in industrialized countries, carbon emissions have leveled off a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's starting to happen. But obviously it's a different story in developing countries. So, yeah. Have to see
what happens.
Yeah.
Good for Idaho.
Good for Idaho. I hope that spreads to other states as well. I'm not sure if any other states have bans specifically on teaching that kind of information.
That'd be interesting to know. Yeah. But just playing, like, devil's advocate, I'm wondering if there's a slippery slope with students getting so engaged with, you know, this is what we want to learn about. Not saying, like, you know, they're going to start teaching a Pokemon class in every single high school.
Right.
That's probably not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I can see how there might be people that think that this could be a bad standard to set. But I'm sure it was not just the student involvement. It was all the other, like, research and science groups that go into this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm just hearing that argument in my head from someone I know.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought about it like that. I wonder if in this case it's more like maybe the students felt as though their education was being censored in some way because mm-hmm. that content was supposed to be there and then it was removed.
Yeah.
So it's a little different than just saying, oh, we think we should be learning this entirely new thing that we want to introduce, but...
Be interesting to know why it was taken out in the first place. I don't see any mention as to why this was taken out.
Cool. Good conversation, Kat. All right, Matt, do you want to give us your Below the Fold for today?
So my Below the Fold is less an article and more a recap. I'm sure all of you are paying attention, but the Winter Olympics were going on in South Korea. The U.S. did, you know, arguably very well with 17-year-old winning, you know, America's first gold for halfpipe, another goal later on, women's downhill slalom.
Curling,
yeah, the most athletic team in the world got men's first gold in curling. And then the women's hockey team upset Canada for the first time in 20 years. It was, you know, one of the best games I've seen in a long time. And to put this into perspective, the goalie was only 7 months old the last time the U.S. women's team won. So this was kind of a big deal. It was a huge upset for Canada.
Yeah.
And I am so sorry.
Sorry.
But to put this in a policy perspective, foreign policy has taken a bit of a hit in the last year as it has sort of fallen out of the spotlight, out of the interest, and the current administration struggles to a large degree in defining what their foreign policy is and understanding the nuances of diplomacy. This was an opportunity for the United States to put its best, you know, men and women forward, and they performed phenomenally. One of my favorite things about the Olympics is, you know, there's a camaraderie between every country. You'll see somebody throw down a great run, and their competitors are at the bottom waiting to cheer for them, you know, give them a pat on the back or take their helmet. But that brings into account, you know, this idea of sports diplomacy, and that, much like with the World Cup for soccer, sport unites, you know, everyone together. You get to interact one-on-one with countries and individuals and ideas you don't usually. So even when governments are, you know, less than successful or don't have the best opinions on the global stage, this competition allows for a reassessment of what's going on in the world around us,
mm-hmm.
Which was great. Unfortunately, the vice president missed an opportunity to extend an olive branch, at least for a couple of weeks, to North Korea. Didn't stand for the joint Korean teams passing by. And our president was stirring the pot with comments of war. So it was nice, at least from a foreign policy perspective, to have at least 2 or 3 weeks of quiet and just enjoyment and watching the world get along.
Yeah,
that was very nice.
And go U.S. women's hockey.
Yeah. How did the North Korea and South Korea what they walked together, right?
Yeah, so they've done this before.
How did that come to be? Oh, they've done it before.
Yeah, they've done it before, and, you know, I think this year, because it was in South Korea, there was a lot of worry as to whether or not there would be conflict, especially with the U.S. and the leader of North Korea going back and forth on Twitter and via press releases. This was an opportunity to make sure everyone was able to participate, a little bit of a guarantee of safety, and, you know, again, that moment of peace, or at least that momentary olive branch for diplomacy between the North and the South.
Yeah. I know for me, at least, and I have, you know, studied only a little amount of the Korean War, but I would say it was definitely moving seeing the North Korean and South Korean athlete holding the torch at the same time and walking it up those stairs. For me, not being Korean and not knowing enough about their conflict, even I thought that that was a very special moment. Can you speak to any sort of foreign policy implications just for Korean relations with the Olympics at large?
This could be, and I don't study, you know, that region of the world, but it is on my radar. My perception is that this is a way for the North to step back from the rhetoric that has been going on, you know, a way to naturally de-escalate the conflict and allow them to return to a little bit of normalcy for a while. Even if that is still contentious and you still have the DMZ and threats going back and forth, at least we get to hit the reset button to a certain degree.
Yeah. Haven't there been sort of talk, like, some, like, talks might be coming together between the U.S. and the Koreas? Or...
Well, I think the rumor is, right, that there was supposed to be a meeting between the U.S. and North Korean delegates, but something happened and it was canceled. Yeah.
What they did have, though, is the North and the South reestablished telephone communications and did have meetings leading up to the Olympics. My take on it is it was probably more to organize, you know, the joint teams as opposed to, you know, a full pursuit of the peace process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's I'm just really inspired by that kind of imagery that came out of the Olympics. And I hope that we can, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if there's any much broader policy implications that come out of it. Mm-hmm. But I can remain hopeful, but...
As a cynic with this, though, the president last week did make a statement on North Korea saying that if they don't meet his first plan, that his second plan is almost, quote, very, very bad and not good for the rest of the world, but it has to be done.
So that's a very specific...
It is... unfortunate, to say the least.
Is it, what is that plan that he's working on?
Probably specific? Military intervention, and the issue with that is it's two nuclear powers going at it, you know, for the first time in actual head-to-head combat, and I think estimates are somewhere around 8 million dead in the first week. Remembering that you have to cross the DMZ, you have large populations in North Korea, and Seoul is only 40 miles from the North Korean border. Which is, I think, a population of 40 million in South Korea. So,
adding to the idea that the Olympics is sort of like a reset button for a lot of different things, or that it even plays a role in foreign policy, wasn't it in the 80s that the U.S. boycotted the Moscow Games?
And historically, you know, issues have happened at Olympic Games. You know, you've got the Munich Games, you've got Russia, the U.S. boycotting one another.
Actually, this might come up later. It says the Soviet invasion spurred Jimmy Carter to issue an ultimatum on January 20th, 1980. The U.S. would boycott the Moscow Games if Soviet troops did not withdraw from Afghanistan in 1 month.
Oh, hey, cool. That's what we're doing.
I'm going to bring that up so I can...
That was supposed
later.
To be a happy topic.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We took it way to... Oh, sorry about that.
We're worse than philosophy students.
Yeah,
go USA.
This
is, I love hockey, but like I actively stayed up till 3 a.m. just to watch him get that. I don't think it should have ended in a shootout, but, like, my adrenaline levels were so high that I wasn't able to get to sleep for a couple more hours.
All right, well, that was supposed to be our lighthearted topic.
You can take whatever you want out
of
it.
Yeah, you can take
guys.
What you want.
Keep it lighthearted, please. I was happy.
So, Jessica, what's your below the
fold? Yeah, so mine is not particularly happy either.
What a year.
Mine is about, it's about the Clean Water Act. So there's been a lot of kind of issues around the Clean Water Act that have come up in the policy community lately. There was an effort to better define what waters of the United States means under the Clean Water Act, which has not been particularly well-defined for 34 years.
Does it flow in a stream?
Well, sort yes, but there's all these weird issues with, like, ephemeral wetlands and, you know, stream beds that are sometimes dry, and are those classified as waters of the U.S. that should be protected under the Clean Air Act? Still kind of a question mark, and at this point, that clarification has been put off for the foreseeable future. But, so, sometimes, for whatever reason, the government needs to move water resources from one water body to another, from one state to another. And there's some environmental groups and some states that believe that any water that's transferred should be subject to oversight by what's called the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Water Transfers Rule, or NPDES, that would basically make sure that there aren't any contaminants in the water that's being moved. But the EPA ended up deciding that states and water resource management agencies should be the ones providing that oversight, not the federal government. And in the past few months, some states and environmental organizations have come forward and said, we think this needs to be reconsidered because there may be situations where, for example, if you take water from a pretty contaminated water body and then move it to a much cleaner one, there may be issues that require federal oversight to make sure that pollution doesn't spread further than it has to. I'm not exactly sure why those environmental organizations feel that state authorities aren't qualified to do that work. But anyway, they wanted the Supreme Court to consider this issue, which would have been a pretty big change to the way the Clean Water Act works and kind of fly in the face of the decisions that the Bush EPA administration made. But this week, the Supreme Court rejected it. So there will be no changes. The National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System exception will still be in place. And I'm still kind of trying to figure out what this means for clean water in the U.S. because I don't see a lot of situations where water would be contaminated while it's being transferred from state to state. My bigger concern is that, again, if you're moving water from some reason from a very contaminated area to a less contaminated area, you could potentially have pollution issues arise in new places. So
how is water transported? Because I'm picturing that you've got a bunch of trucks that they pumped it into.
Yeah.
Or is it something like, you know, California's got the levee system where we move water north to south. We've got the Colorado River where you take it from, you know, Colorado to Arizona to Southern California.
Yeah, I would say all of the above. Okay. Probably pipes as well, piping systems. Any kind of, like, irrigation that redirects rivers, that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm not sure how it's legally defined, but in my mind that's how I'm picturing what they're addressing. So it's kind of, maybe this is kind of complicated for a below the fold, but I just think it's interesting that the Clean Water Act, when it was enacted, Congress left so much unspecified and unsaid.
It was very ambiguous.
Yeah.
When you drafted it.
Yeah, it was. And whether there's kind of a big question as to how much Congress intended to leave to the states and the water management agencies versus how much it wanted agencies to figure out at the federal level.
Here's a question. Is there a standard for all of these water management agencies, or Nevada could say, we only want, like, this level of fluoride, or I don't know anything about water chemistry, but maybe you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, totally. That I'm actually not sure, but I guess you're kind of bringing up that there's, like, an interstate commerce issue that might justify congressional, you know,
federal involvement
yeah, to some degree. Yeah.
But we've also got federal standards for what's, you know, legally allowed to what degrees in water. So
yes.
That could go into that.
Yeah. You mean like pollutant levels and things
Or if it becomes a thing where it's one state providing water for maybe 7 or 8 states, maybe that would be in a situation where you would want some federal oversight since it's stretching across such a wider group.
Yeah,
of
like the headwaters of the Rio Grande or something like that.
Yeah. Or in two of one state. He wants to close that dam, which limits water downstream.
Yeah, yeah. Water's pretty contentious legally, yeah. So it's something I'm beginning to learn more about, and it's fascinating. But, yeah, so we'll see. I wonder as well when the Clean Water Act, the whole WOTUS rule is going to be. I really like that they call it WOTUS, Waters of the United States. Have you heard that before?
No.
I think it's really cute. But, yeah, so that, because that was the big legal question that the Obama administration tried to tackle, was what fits under the definition of WOTUS. So I hope they revisit that conversation soon, because I think it's really important, and it's led to a lot of legal problems in administering the Clean Water Act. It's been very costly for states. So.
Well, I know it's starting to get redefined. There's some legislation out there. I was just reading it today, so I'm kicking myself because I can't remember the bill number. But it is repealing what they count as runoff from power plants or from, you know, LNG or oil extraction. So it's not so much that you can pollute water. It's more an issue of, well, we don't consider this water or this runoff is acceptable. So it's going to become an issue again. You know, the Clean Water Act was huge, especially when it came out of Appalachia, mountaintop mining, coal mines, and water sources up there, which were the headwaters, were getting polluted all the way down to Georgia and South Carolina. So this is a cross-state issue and something going on in West Virginia.
Is this new legislation?
The bill that I'm talking about repealing what they consider pollutant, I think, is this Congress.
Okay. It's just interesting that that's coinciding with infrastructure.
Yes.
Bills.
Yeah. But it's also coinciding with LNG is liquefied natural gas, so fracking and other extraction, especially when that has a tendency to pollute the water, too.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of developments in water, so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But did anyone else have any other comments you guys wanted to throw out before we close the loop? That's not to be included in the episode.
Bad jokes about being underwater.
No. Oh. Darn, you shouldn't make mine like the bad jokes. But yeah, so that's going to close up our Below the Fold today. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks, Matt, for joining us and
thanks for having
telling
me.
Us all about the Olympics. Good to know.
Go USA.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's Below the Fold, brought to you by GW Wattcast, the independent podcast of the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at GW Wattcast. Or you can send us love letters and hate mail at wattcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Kelly Gunther. Thanks for listening.